There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dimensions, the Twilight Zone podcast. I'm your host, Bill Couch. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 24, titled The Rip Van Winkle Caper. This episode was written by Rod Serling, directed by Justice Addis, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant, Renee Gerwink, Jerry Goldsmith, Bernard Herrmann, and Van Cleve. In the cast were Oscar Beregi, Simon Oakland, Lou Gallo, and John Mitchum. Its original air date was April 21st of 1961. And as always, you can watch it on Paramount Plus or the DVDs or Blu-rays. And again, as I always say, if you have a little bit extra spending cash, buy the Blu-rays, especially if you like physical media, which some people do. I know everything's going digital now. I think Best Buy doesn't even sell physical media anymore. They're about to be done with it completely. But Amazon still sells it. So, you know, if you so desire, buy the Blu-rays, as I always say. And as always, if you haven't watched this episode since Archie Bunker said the N-word on national television, then, you know, maybe give it another watch before you listen to this episode of the podcast. And as always, because there are spoilers ahead, be forewarned if you haven't seen it before. And with that, let's get into the opening narration. Introducing four experts in the questionable art of crime. Mr. Farwell, an expert on noxious gases, former professor with a doctorate in both chemistry and physics. Mr. Irby, expert in mechanical engineering. Mr. Brooks, expert in use of firearms and other weaponry. And Mr. DeCruz, expert in demolition and various forms of destruction. The time is now. The place is a mountain cave in Death Valley, USA, and in just a moment, these four men will utilize the services of a truck placed in Cosmoline, loaded with a hot ice cooled off by a century of sleep, and then take a drive into the Twilight Zone. I will say, growing up as a kid and watching the Twilight Zone, as I did on WGN Channel 9 in Chicago, as I did when I was a child, I do not remember this one necessarily getting a lot of repeats in syndication or, you know, ever really showing up on the rotation of episodes that were played. But I have found that over the years, I've come to appreciate this episode as quite a character study in deception and evil and various forms of, well, shall we say, the art of crime, as Mr. Serling basically put it. I really like this episode, so let's crack into it. You have four men who put a trainload of people to sleep and stole $100 million worth of gold bullion that was headed for the Federal Reserve or Fort Knox or wherever we store gold in this country. These men put the people to sleep, walked over their sleeping bodies to carry off the gold bullion, load it into a truck, drive it into Death Valley, and park it in a cave, all off screen before we even see the episode beginning. So we meet them at the cave where the crux of the story is going to take place. For about the first half of the story, it takes place in the cave. Now, their mastermind of an idea was to steal all this gold, load it onto a truck, preserve the truck as best they could, preserve themselves as best they could, wake up in 100 years, and walk off into the sunset as free men with $100 million in gold bullion, which would, at least in their minds, be worth exponentially more 100 years in the future. Now, the interesting thing of this episode is where we get everyone sleeping for 100 years. Now, how did they do this? They have glass coffins, essentially glass coffins, more like glass boxes, where they would lay down in them, and Mr. Farwell, being the expert in the gases, rigged everyone's sleeping chamber, so to speak, to deliver a dose of gas that will keep them basically in a suspended animated state, where they would wake up somewhere around 100 years in the future, so that they could spend their money and live like free men, free of the law, for the crime of theft of $100 million in gold bullion. So the idea is they get in the boxes and wake up 100 years in the future. So we see them get into the boxes. Farwell gives them the instructions about, you know, make sure the air latches are locked, and then hit the button, the gas will come in, breathe normally, and you'll be asleep, and 100 years will wake up. So they do that. The truck is placed away. They get in the coffins. They push the buttons. Gas fills the chambers, and they sleep. They wake up. They get out of the coffins, 3 of the 4 of them, I should say. And we come to find out that there's somewhat of a disagreement as to how long they were actually asleep, because they open the door to the cave and Death Valley still looks like Death Valley. You know, there's no Hilton Resort in the middle of Death Valley with, you know, people in spacesuits enjoying a dip in the pool. It's just Death Valley. Surprise, surprise. So some argument goes on back and forth, and the argument continues until they notice that Irby did not get out of his sleep chamber because he is now a skeleton. A rock at some point in time had fallen, broken a hole in his sleep chamber, killed him, and reduced him to a skeleton. So Irby is dead. They figure that at least a year, if not 100 years, has passed, because it would take a year or so for the body to be like that. So they kind of figure, hey, we've been asleep the requisite number of years. Of course, they have an argument about, well, my fingernails and my hair didn't grow, and of course, Farwell reassures them that in a state of suspended animation, none of their bodily functions like hair and nail growth would happen. So they look like they did 100 years previous. As Farwell put it, we've taken 100 years and put it in our hip pocket. Which I always loved that I always loved that little bit of dialogue. But I mean, Oscar Beregi is a phenomenal actor. Anyway, and we'll see him again. More on that when we get to the bios. So, with Irby dead, it's just Farwell, Brooks, and DeCruz. Well, DeCruz gets the idea that he doesn't like odd numbers, and so he decides to run over Mr. Brooks with the truck, subsequently losing control of the truck because the brakes don't work, the truck therefore going over into a ravine, and the $100 million in bullion going with it. And so, with no truck and nowhere, no Hilton Resort right down the way, with people in spacesuits taking a dip in the pool, they're resorted to packing as much gold as each can carry on their person and walking to the nearest town. So, of course, Oscar Beregi, being a more plump individual than Mr. DeCruz, and also slightly older, at least by appearance, obviously the road is a little harder traveled for Mr. Farwell than it is for Mr. DeCruz. So they have to stop frequently because they're crossing Death Valley, and we come to find that Farwell has lost his canteen. Must have dropped it at the last place they stopped. And so DeCruz gets the idea that a swallow of gold will cost Farwell a gold bar. And who knows what the next day will bring. He'd have to check the gold market for that. But for the current day that they're on, it's a 1-for-1 exchange rate. So Farwell, not doing well, decides to start purchasing drinks of water from Mr. DeCruz, and they sleep through the night. They get up the next morning. They still have quite a ways to go. Of course, Farwell still doesn't have a canteen, but DeCruz still does. And now the new rate of exchange is 2 gold bars. For one swallow, and this occurs until Oscar Beregi, Mr. Farwell, has about the equivalent of 1 gold bar left. He has 3 left. He gives 2 to DeCruz for a drink of water. When DeCruz gives him a drink of water and he's putting his gold away, Farwell takes his remaining gold bar and bashes DeCruz over the head, taking the rest of the water and the knapsack of gold that he has. Then Farwell, of course, passes out in the middle of the road. Of course, none of this throughout this time, they have not seen any sort of vehicle. Farwell drops down on the road, where at this time a space vehicle comes by. And the man gets out and checks on Farwell, who says he'd give him a gold bar if he would just take him into town and help him. Before the man could do anything, Farwell passes away. The man takes the gold bar and shows it to his wife, and the idea, the notion of, hey, look at this. This guy had a gold bar. He actually thought this was worth something. And she says, well, wasn't it worth something about 100 years ago? And the guy said, yeah, before we figured out how to synthesize it and make it. It's worth, basically nothing now, pennies. And the episode ends with the man telling the woman, when we get into town, we'll tell somebody to come pick this guy up. And that ends the episode. So with that, we will get the closing narration. The last of 4 Rip Van Winkles, who all died precisely the way they lived, chasing an idol across the sand to wind up bleached dry in the hot sun, as so much desert flotsam, worthless as the gold bullion they built a shrine to. Tonight's lesson: in the Twilight Zone. So, the episode ends. Nobody wins. Everybody loses. Everybody dies. Happy ending. End of story. Now, as nice of an episode as this is, and I say that as having every main character die some tragic way, it is a really good story. It is a really good, and a lot of really good movies and television shows and things like that have been built upon, somewhat of this idea of, you know, a cast of characters, criminals usually stuck in a place or in a certain area, and you get to a last man standing, and that man either gets away or perishes as well. Something that, I mean, that comes straight to mind would be the 1992 film by Quentin Tarantino called Reservoir Dogs. And if you've never seen it, it's very gruesome, very bloody, very Tarantino-esque. But is it a it is a fantastic movie, and it's a fantastic character study of something similar to this. Except in the movie Reservoir Dogs, it's diamonds and not gold bullion. And another sort of, not necessarily similar, but in the same sort of idea that comes to mind, is Die Hard with a Vengeance. Jeremy Irons tries to make off with four dump trucks full of gold that he steals from the Federal Reserve in New York City. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen that movie, but it's been 30 years. Hopefully you've seen it by now. Same with Reservoir Dogs. But those are just a few examples of kind of a similar thing, although with Die Hard with a Vengeance is a little different because it's set over the length of a city, whereas in this episode it's mainly in a cave and then on the road to a town that no one ever gets to, and it ends before anyone ever gets there. So a little different, but definitely a couple of companion pieces to this episode if you just so desire. It's a great character study, I think, this episode. Now, that's not to say it doesn't have its flaws, because it, by George, has a lot of flaws in it. It's one of those episodes I like to watch with the idea that I am suspending any sort of reality to watch this episode. Now, does that mean I don't like this episode? Absolutely not. It does not mean I do not like this episode. I like this episode, but I turn my brain off when I watch it, because I know if I think too hard about it, I won't like this episode, because there's a lot of things that don't necessarily add up, so to speak, in this episode, and we'll get to those shortly. But for now, why don't we start with the bios of the men who would be Rip Van Winkle. Not to be confused with Rob Van Winkle, also known as Vanilla Ice. So let's meet the man who turned into a skeleton with absolutely no clothing on in his little sleep pod when a rock fell and busted the coffin. He, Mr. Irby, was played by John Mitchum. John Mitchum was born in 1919 and passed away in 2001 at the age of 82. Now, John Mitchum was the son of a mother who was Norwegian and a father who was a half-Irish, half-Blackfoot Indian, whom he never knew because he was killed in a train accident the year that he was born. Now, what's interesting about John Mitchum? You might know that last name. He is Robert Mitchum's brother. So, not the most interesting thing about him, by the way, but just to know that show business ran in this family, which is to say that his sister ran off to join a vaudeville act after the family moved to a farm in Delaware. Farm life not suiting them, both he and Robert went to New York City, where in the streets of Hell's Kitchen, they were known as them Henri Mitchum boys because they got into a lot of fights. This brought on the Depression, where the family was forced to separate, and their idea was to meet up with their sister Annette, the one who joined the vaudeville circuit, who had married a sailor and moved to California. They hitchhiked and rode the rails until they got to California, where their Eastern accents didn't necessarily help them out much. So with a little bit of doing, they changed the way they talked to more fit in with the locals. Robert Mitchum went on to, of course, become Hollywood icon Robert Mitchum, where John sort of took a little bit of a longer route to get into there. He started out being a sailor, a professional boxer, and a choir conductor. This somewhat led him into acting, where he found his sort of niche as a character actor, mostly playing heavies, since he was somewhat of an imposing figure of a man. One of his first roles was playing alongside Humphrey Bogart in the 1949 picture Knock on Any Door. Also playing with Gladys Knight in the movie Pipe Dreams in 1976. In between, of course, doing an episode of The Twilight Zone. But a lot of people might know him as Clint Eastwood's sidekick in the first three Dirty Harry movies, with a character named DiGiorgio. He also played opposite John Wayne in the 1970 picture Chisholm, and it was during the production of Chisholm that John Wayne offered his voice for an anthology of John Mitchum's poetry that was based upon the uplifting of American culture, titled America, Why I Love Her. The recording was nominated for a Grammy in 1973. John, ever being a storyteller and, of course, musician slash singer, being the with his choral background, led to him creating the recording Our Land, Our Heritage with Dan Blocker, a.k.a. Hoss from Bonanza, in 1964. John's career over the years spanned some 58 movies and several television programs, along with some recurring roles throughout his television career, such as Pickalong from Riverboat or Hoffenmuller from F Troop, and over 150 appearances overall in his 50-year career. The Mitchum brothers also had a biography written of them, titled Them Henri Mitchum Boys, published in 1989. The subjects range from brother Robert Mitchum escaping a Georgia chain gang, to John surviving an attacking whale on a three-masted schooner, and their adventures riding the rails. This was not his only Twilight Zone appearance, by the way. He appeared in two episodes, one being the Rip Van Winkle Caper, and the last one being Season 5, Episode 32, Mr. Garrity and the Graves, which is another one of those ones that you kind of suspend disbelief, but you love as well. And we'll get to that when we get to that. But as we said, he also passed away at the age of 82 in 2001. Now, next, we have the man who would be Brooks, who lasted not as long as DeCruz or Farwell, but definitely longer than Irby by about 7 minutes, and that would be Lou Gallo. Lou was born in 1928 and passed away at the age of 71 in the year 2000. Now, Lou graduated from Ithaca College in 1951 and then attended graduate school at Columbia University from 1954 to 55. Now, interesting enough, Ithaca College is where Rod Serling kind of took a sabbatical from the Twilight Zone, but we'll get to that in due time, good people. Lou went on to receive Ithaca College's Lifetime Achievement Award posthumously in 2001. He founded the golf tournament for the Entertainment Industry Foundation and served as a member of the foundation's board. He began golf tournaments for St. John of God Care Center and Via Scalabrini Retirement Home, and in 1998 was named Man of the Year by the Los Angeles Italian American Golf Association. Now, Lou had 98 credits to his IMDb, going all the way back to the first one being in the television show Frontier Justice in 1958, along with an episode of Studio One the same year. He acted in a lot of shows throughout the 50s and 60s, including 77 Sunset Strip, Zane Grey Theater, Fury, Death Valley Days, stop me if you've heard this, Perry Mason. He was in the 1960 movie Ocean's 11, starring, of course, Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack, if you will. He was also in episodes of Rawhide, Checkmate, Tales of Wells Fargo. Like I said, stop me if you've heard this. He was also in 3 episodes of The Twilight Zone. He was in The Hitchhiker in season 1. He was, of course, in this one, and we will see him again in season 4 in the episode On Thursday We Leave for Home, which is a lot of people's one of the favorites among a lot of people of the hour-long episodes. So we'll see him again, never fear. But with all of these television shows, he kept himself busy until he decided to work behind the camera some, being a producer, a director, and a writer, in which his last writing job was writing the treatment for the 2007 movie I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, with Adam Sandler and everyone's favorite fat guy, Kevin James. So, a little interesting side note there. His last on-screen role was in a 1991 movie titled Baby of the Bride, which was a TV movie. So, he had a varied career over the years, but not a whole lot is known about him. And sadly, he passed away at the age of 71 in the year 2000 from complications from an aortic aneurysm. So let's go on to the man who lived almost as long as Farwell, the man who played DeCruz, Mr. Simon Oakland. Now, Simon Oakland was born in 1915 and passed away at the age of 68 in 1983. Now, he was a character actor who was a very memorable tough guy. But what you might not know about him is he began his career as a concert violinist, turning to acting in the late 40s after a string of roles in Broadway hits, including Light Up the Sky, The Shrike, and Inherit the Wind. He made his film debut as the tough but compassionate journalist who speaks up for Susan Hayward's Barbara Graham character in the movie I Want to Live in 1958. He would go on to play a series of tough guys, usually on the right side of the law, although not in this episode of The Twilight Zone, but usually on the right side of the law in such films as 1966's The Sand Pebbles, 1967's Tony Rome, and most notably Lieutenant Shrank in West Side Story in 1961. Now, you may have recognized him before if you're a fan of Rod Serling and Alfred Hitchcock, which usually those names usually go together. If you like the movie Psycho, you might remember Mr. DeCruz from this episode, a.k.a. Simon Oakland, being the man that played the psychologist at the end of the movie Psycho that tells us about Norman Bates' dual personality disorder. Now, he didn't limit his talents only to the big screen or to Broadway. He was also a regularly seen face on television as well, and at one point serving as a regular or semi-regular player on 4 different television series at the same time. He was also very much loved and respected by anyone who co-starred with him. And this won't be the last time we see him in The Twilight Zone as well. We will also see him in Season 4's The 30 Fathom Grave, which is regarded as not one of the best hour-long episodes of The Twilight Zone, but we will get there when we get there. And sadly, Mr. Oakland died after complications of a long battle with cancer at the age of 68 in 1983. And that brings us to the ultimo hombre, the last man standing, who wasn't standing for very long at the end, Oscar Beregi, or also known as Oscar Beregi Jr. Now, he was born in 1918 and sadly passed away somewhat early, at the age of 58 in 1976. He was a Hungarian-born actor, of course, if you couldn't tell from his of his accent that he had. Most of his best performances were on the small screen, usually as Eastern European or Russian heavies. His stock in trade, so to speak, was being a villain, usually cultured or psychological, rather than physical in nature. Now, he was known as Oscar Beregi Jr. Why? Because his father, Oscar Beregi Sr., had been a matinee idol and appeared on the Hungarian and German stage in Shakespeare roles as well as acting in films since 1919. Both he and his father left Hungary in 1939, the father settling in the United States, while Oscar Beregi Jr., went to Chile and ran a restaurant. It took several years for Oscar Beregi Jr. to be granted a visa to enter the U.S., and the only reason he was granted the visa was because then U.S. Senator Lyndon B. Johnson intervened on his behalf. So after taking a detour to Chile to run a restaurant and having to get future President LBJ to help him get across the border, Beregi spoke very little English and worked as a salesman for several years, learning the language as he went, before re-entering his love and passion of being an actor well into middle age. Now, with that being said, he was mostly in movies in smaller parts, never really getting a big part in movies. However, on the small screen, he got some quite fantastic roles and really went to town with them, such as being the character of mob boss Joe Kulak in 8 episodes of The Untouchables. He was also very well loved in this episode of The Twilight Zone, as well as the other episode of The Twilight Zone that we will see him in, titled Death's Head Revisited. And, when we get there, if you don't already know that episode, which if you're listening to this, I'm sure you've seen it a dozen times, but Beregi is the standout. I mean, that man kills it. He absolutely murders it in that role in Death's Head Revisited. Now, he wasn't always playing a former Nazi or something of that nature. He was also good in comedic roles, using somewhat parodying his evil persona in 1966's I'm Only Human, 1969's To Kill a Mockingbird, and in one of my personal favorite movies, 1974's Young Frankenstein. And just as a side of trivia, in his private life, his off time, he was a successful breeder of Commodores, which is a large white Hungarian sheepdog. But sadly, we lost him too early in 1976 at the age of 58 after suffering a heart attack. Now, I know what you're going to say, Bill, you forgot about Justice Addis, the director. No, I didn't. But we already covered his biography in Season 2, Episode 18's The Odyssey of Flight 33. So if you want to hear more about Justice Addis, go back and listen to that episode, and listen to that episode anyway, because it's a good one. But overall, he only directed 3 episodes. Of course, The Odyssey of Flight 33, Rip Van Winkle Caper, and then in Season 4, he directed the episode No Time Like the Past. So we will see Justice Addis one more time before his tenure in the Twilight Zone is finished. Now with that, let's move into the trivia. The futuristic vehicle, which is shown at the end of the episode, which the man and the woman that stopped to help Farwell are riding in, is a modified version of Robbie the Robot's car, first constructed by MGM for the science fiction classic Forbidden Planet, which, of course, the Twilight Zone raided their prop department heavily. When DeCruz, Farwell, and Brooks awaken from their suspended animation in 2061, they discover that Irby is no longer with them, as he is a skeleton, caused by a falling rock cracking his chamber. This is reminiscent of the scene in Planet of the Apes in which Taylor, Dodge, and Landon discover the desiccated corpse of their fellow astronaut Stewart in his stasis pod, which malfunctioned and caused air to leak. Much like this episode, Planet of the Apes was written by Rod Serling, so he liked to somewhat borrow some stuff and use it in other places. $1 million in gold would weigh 28,000 ounces or 1,760 pounds. The title, of course, refers to the story written by Washington Irving and published in 1819. This episode, of course, takes place in 1961 and in our future of 2061. This episode aired immediately after the previous episode of 100 Yards Over the Rim, which makes it the second story in a row centered on a protagonist encountering people from the future. And the majority of the music that was written for this episode, or that was used in this episode, was written in 1946 by Bernard Herrmann for a radio play titled The Moat Farm Murder, adapted by Norman Corwin from actual trial transcripts and performed by Orson Welles. The music was later re-recorded for use in the CBS Stock Music Library. It appeared in several installments of The Twilight Zone. Now with that, let's head on to the goofs. So, obviously, the truck would have been useless after 100 years for several reasons. Number one, the gasoline in the truck would have evaporated or broken down to the point of uselessness. The oil would have dried up or have hardened or become so gummy it would have been useless as well. The truck's battery would have gone flat within months due to degradation. The tires on the truck, if not rotted away, would surely have been completely flat and useless, even if they would have used solid tires like I know some military vehicles use. The oil, the gas wouldn't have made it, even if you pack it in Cosmoline or whatever they say they did. When the gang pushes the rock that was in front of the cave, a track can be seen that it moves on. At the end, when Farwell is dead, you can see him still breathing. And when the men awake from their sleep, they must release the latch, the air latch that made the glass cases airtight. But Brooks, when he wakes up, just literally pushes the lid of the chamber open without releasing any latch. So with that, let's get to the likes and dislikes of this episode. I liked it. I always did, and I always will, most likely. Mainly on the strong performance of Oscar Beregi and Simon Oakland, playing, of course, DeCruz and Farwell. I love the idea of the story. Like I said, you know, companion pieces being Reservoir Dogs and Die Hard with a Vengeance. I know that it might sound funny, but give them both a look and tell me if there's not some correlations there. Minus the time travel, of course. Both are, you know, they're all three great movies. Of course, Reservoir Dogs in this episode being great character studies in villainy and crime and that sort of thing. Dislikes, of course, the very idea that that everything would have been able to, you know, you could still drive the truck and so on and so forth, and the fact that Farwell and DeCruz wouldn't have been able to carry the amount of gold that they had, and even if they had, Farwell and or DeCruz wouldn't be able to carry his share plus Farwell's share that Farwell traded him for sips of water along the way, so that wouldn't have worked. So, you know, if you look at it with the eye of a critic, you can certainly find a lot to nitpick about this episode, but don't do that. All 20 of you listening, don't do that. Just enjoy it for what it is. It's a great bit of acting. It's a nice little story. It's a fun little sci-fi romp through Death Valley, ending in the death of everyone involved, minus the two futuristic people in spacesuits that I am assuming are going to the Hilton to go for a dip. So, with that being said, I like this episode, but if you really look at it, it falls apart on its, the devil's in the details, and the devil certainly shows up in this episode. So maybe, you know, tell me what you think. Write me, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. Did you like this episode? Did you hate this episode? Did you want to punch DeCruz in the face several times and bash him with the gold bar long before Farwell ever did? Who knows? Let me know. Write me. Tell me. I'd love to hear it. And with that, let's move on to casting for this episode. So for casting, for DeCruz, I went with Andy Garcia. No, why? Because the man's a fantastic actor. You don't see him that much anymore. He's fantastic. He's awesome. He should be in way more things. And I think he could actually, if you know any of his work, you've seen him. He could absolutely play a just vile, evil villain. He's good at it. And as for Farwell, I'd pack on about 30 pounds of mass to Christoph Waltz and send him waltzing across Death Valley with a sack of gold on his back and no canteen in his belt. And I think that would be fantastic. Seeing Andy Garcia and Christoph Waltz playing off each other, I think would be fantabulous. I think. And then for Brooks and Irby, and I know you're going to think I'm stupid, I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but I would cast Macaulay Culkin as Brooks and Kieran Culkin, his brother, as Irby. I just think that would be funny, because they're not really in it long enough for it to matter, so it's not like you're going to see the kid from Home Alone slap his cheeks and scream, because he's not even that kind of, you know, he doesn't look like that anymore anyway. So I just think it would be funny because they're not in it long enough to do it. And they're both actually good actors. You know, I know a lot of people like to talk a lot of trash about at least Macaulay, if not Kieran, although they're both actually really good actors. And I think it would be funny to see them in this remade sort of episode, if it were to be remade. Now, for the moral and philosophy, I mean, do we really even need to go into it? Stealing's bad, obviously. Be careful what you wish for, because you may just get it, you know, that sort of thing. And as always, as I've said before, not too long ago, contrary to what Gordon Gekko might say in Wall Street, greed is, in fact, not good. So don't be greedy. Don't be an idiot. Don't cross Death Valley without any sort of water while you're carrying 100 pounds or better of gold on your back. So I think we could all learn from that. Now, listener feedback. I got a little. So while we're at it, why don't we go over it? So this email comes from our somewhat newer listener, Doug, who writes, "Hey, Bill, had a couple of questions and a couple of corrections. During the 5 years of the Twilight Zone, there were 3 U.S. presidents. Of course, Eisenhower, JFK, and LBJ. I know they recognized Kennedy in a few episodes, which they certainly did. Did they ever acknowledge a sitting president like Eisenhower or Johnson? I don't believe so. I don't believe I've ever heard it," he says. I don't either. I know Kennedy was mentioned. Beyond that, I can't think of any. I can't think of any either. Next question. Did Rod Serling write the narrations for the opening or closing of the episodes? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It just depends on the writer of the episode. Sometimes he wrote them. Sometimes they were written by the actual author. And certainly in the later seasons, when Rod didn't really have a whole lot to do with the show other than flying to Hollywood for a week or two to record all the season's opening and closings, monologues, not necessarily, no. So in the beginning, yes, he probably wrote a good portion of them. Toward the end, he wrote very little of them. All right, he goes on to write, I have a tall order, but it would be great if you could manage it. He goes on to say, during season one, you had a guest. Yes, I did. Catherine, who is a lovely, lovely, lovely lady who I would love to have back on the show. And I certainly plan to, but with her living her life in several states away and me living my life, as much as you could call it a life, several states away, her being an accomplished author, me being absolutely nothing, sometimes it can be hard to get schedules together. And, but I definitely plan on having her back. She is a massive Jack Klugman fan, and by goodness, who isn't? The man was a national treasure, and if you don't love him, you don't love America. I said it, I stand by it. What are you gonna do about it? Absolutely nothing, because Jack Klugman. How can you hate Jack Klugman? You can't hate Jack Klugman. It's impossible. But anyway, I'm sorry. So he goes on to say, she was great. Is there any way you could get Rod Serling's daughter Anne as a guest? I know she wrote a book about her father, so she doesn't seem to shy away about talking about him. You can ask her if she has any stories or remembers any facts about the episodes, and would be a great guest. I agree, although with 20 listeners, I doubt Anne Serling would want to appear on just a pokey little podcast like mine, although I'd love to have her. I'd love to talk to her for about 7 days. If I had the opportunity, and I'm certainly not against trying. So we will see what happens in the future. I'm definitely not against it. Let me see what I can do. I'll be like your parents when they wanted to, when you wanted to go somewhere and they didn't want to take you. I'll say, we'll see. So that's about the best I can do right now is a we'll see, but it's definitely on my radar. He goes on to say, also, older guests from the Twilight Zone would be great. There's not that many left, so time is of the essence. I agree. I have tried to look down a few of them, but haven't really gotten anywhere. I will still continue to try to get a hold of some people as well to be guests on the show. So we'll see. That's my best answer that I can give you currently, Doug. Let's see. He goes on to say, my only corrections were two of them. First, you spoke about the 10-episode limited series, 11-22-63. I agree with you that it was excellent. The only thing you said, it revolved around Abraham Lincoln's assassination and not JFK's. Yeah, whoops. I may have actually corrected that at some point in an episode since then. But yeah, if I said Abraham Lincoln, I was, yeah, completely mistaken. It was, or completely, probably thinking of something else, but it was definitely JFK. But again, anybody of the other 19 people besides Doug and myself, if you haven't seen the Hulu series 11-22-63, even if you don't have Hulu, do the 7-day free trial, knock out the 10 episodes. It's a fantastic series, and I recommend anyone to watch it. And it's definitely about JFK, not Abraham Lincoln. The other correction he goes on to write was that you said the only actors from Bewitched that were on the show were Dick York and Agnes Moorehead. Actually, you forgot about Elizabeth Montgomery, who appears in the episode 2 alongside Charles Bronson. That's absolutely correct. I thought I actually corrected that as well. I probably didn't. My brain doesn't work as good as it used to. So yeah, I forgot Elizabeth Montgomery. They actually had to ugly her up to be in the episode, which I always thought was hilarious because she's an absolutely stunning woman. And the fact that they had to ugly her up like they did Charlize Theron in the movie Monster. If you haven't seen that, it's a great movie too. So give that a look as well. He goes on to conclude by saying, I enjoy your podcast. Keep up the great work. Your friend and listener, Doug. And as always, Doug, thank you so much for writing in. And if anybody else wants to write in as well, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback as well, much like Mr. Doug has done. Certainly I'm not above fallibility, and certainly aren't we all not above it. But with that being said, we are getting into the thick of things in the series of The Twilight Zone. And I say that because next week's episode is certainly a great episode. I don't want you to miss it. It's about a man who makes a bet that he can't shut up for a year. So stay tuned for the next episode titled The Silence. As always, thank you everybody for listening. I do appreciate all 20 of you. Tell a buddy, bring a friend. Don't dare miss it. Thank you, everybody. Have a good week, and good night.